This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Unnecessary Roughness, Inside the Trial and Final Days of Aaron Hernandez, by Jose Baez with George Willis, read by Ben Jeffrey and Shayna Small. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of images. Dedication. When Aaron Hernandez and I sat down for 2 days straight as he told me his entire life story, I could not believe the incredible life he had lived in such a short time. I thought the story was the most interesting I had ever heard, but I also felt it would never see the light of day. It wasn't until after his trial was over and we awaited the verdict that we discussed the idea that I could be the one to tell his story. His interest in the project was not a forecast of his intentions to commit suicide, as much as an acknowledgement that he was tired of people who didn't know him telling lies or spinning the truth. Ethically, I could not tell his story without his informed consent, so I gave him time to think about it. A couple of days later, he told me, "I want you to tell it, Jose, and don't hold back. Tell the good, the bad, and the ugly." I told him I would think about it, and I really had no intention of revisiting the subject until after his death. Aaron's death has affected me in ways I cannot begin to describe. You're not taught in law school how to deal with situations and scenarios like the ones I encountered with Aaron. I could not sit idly by as people who didn't even know him came out of the woodwork telling outrageous stories about Aaron. He was dead, but many people were not content until they could dance on his grave. This story is filled with tragedy and victims. Daniel De Abreu, Zafiro Furtado, Odin Lloyd, Aaron Hernandez, their families, and the countless football players who carry inside them the silent killer of CTE, including the children who play this game, idolizing their heroes on the gridiron. It is for this reason that I dedicate this book to a number of children. First, to two very special children in my heart. To Aviel Hernandez, may you take the gift that God and your parents have given you and live life to the fullest, and remember that your father had so many wonderful qualities and touched many people in many special ways. His truth will always lie in your heart, as you are the living proof of the good in him. He loved you beyond words and will always be by your side. To my own son, Jose Baez Jr., who will never play tackle football, so don't even think about it. What many people don't know is during the trial I was also going through a divorce and my family was adjusting to a new way of life. It was you, my son, who inspired me then and still do, along with your sister, Christina, to hope that one day you will be proud of your daddy. I am already proud of you and love you with all my heart and soul. To all of the children whose parents might listen to this audiobook and realize that a game is not worth the risk of a future, this brain disease is real, and I pray for your parents' wisdom. God bless you all.
Forward. Shayana Jenkins Hernandez. When I signed the papers giving Aaron's brain to the Boston University Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy, CTE, Center, it was a decision I made as his fiancé, along with Aaron's defense team. If I could potentially help someone else, why not do it? Also, I wanted answers. I wanted to know why my fiancé died, just when there was hope he might someday come home. There's still a ton of answers I want. But this is a start. This may sound weird to say about someone you love, but I feel like CTE researchers hit the jackpot when they got Aaron's brain. Of course the news that he had stage 3 CTE, how severe it was, and that he had the brain of someone so much older, was devastating for us to hear. But if examining the condition of his brain can help others, especially football players, Aaron would be pleased. It's like he's back on a team again. I have loved Aaron Hernandez since we were in high school. I will love him until the day I die. I miss his smile every day, and I miss seeing him being a father to our daughter. My prayer is that he is finally at peace. Free of chains, bars, courtrooms, and judgment. I cried when Jose Baez and his law partner, Ron Sullivan, told me the news that Aaron had suffered such a severe case of CTE. After all we had been through, his arrest, his trials, and his death, it was still devastating news. I cried because I realized I had tried to help him for so long, but there was nothing I could have done. I cried because there was a battle going on within his brain, and he didn't even know it. None of us did. We met in grade school, became friends in middle school, and were sweethearts at Bristol Central High School. I ran track. He was a football player. He was very popular, and I was just trying to get through school and get good grades. He had girls vying for his attention, and I had a strict mom at home who was a single parent. But even though we were raised differently, we got along. We talked. We became close. When he left for the University of Florida, I went to community college and let him do his own thing. He was a baby. I wanted him to grow up and experience all he needed to experience. Our relationship was on and off until he showed up at my work one day, not long after he was drafted by the Patriots. I was working three jobs, but soon moved into his apartment in Plainview, Massachusetts. Then I became pregnant with Aviel. He proposed at my baby shower in front of almost 50 people. And in what seems like a blink, Aviel was born on Aaron's birth date. We moved into our dream home, and everything was going the way it was supposed to. Life wasn't perfect by any means, but it was close. Then on June 26, 2013, he was arrested and charged with shooting Odin Lloyd, and our lives were never the same. My sympathies go out to all the victims. Murder can never be condoned. But Aaron never got a fair trial, in the media or in court. He listened to people he thought would give him the best legal advice, and although they tried, I don't think they tried hard enough, which makes me extremely upset. We could have avoided so much, and maybe he would still be alive. When I heard the guilty verdict, it kicked in that he wasn't coming home. I was going to have to raise our child all by myself and lose the love of my life, all in one fell swoop. I cried even more when in 2017, he was found innocent of an earlier crime, the 2012 Boston double murders of Daniel De Abreu and Safira Furtado, because I knew there was victory ahead. He was finally acquitted. We, Jose and his team were his defense attorneys, knew our fighting wasn't going to waste. That's why I believe Aaron cried so much when they said not guilty. We had waited so long and fought so hard. We realized we were moving in the right direction. When someone from the prison informed me by telephone that Aaron had died, I cried the tears that come with tragedy. I first called my lawyers to try to figure out whether it was a hoax, because people had been very cruel. After the victory he had, and having spoken to him the day before, I couldn't imagine him committing suicide. A few calls later, I learned it was true. Aaron was dead. I thought, what do I do now? I raced to the hospital, but the doctors wouldn't let me be with him. His death was still under investigation, they said. Someone told me he wasn't even at the hospital, but that was a lie because I saw him being wheeled into a room. He had died alone. I didn't want him to be alone any longer. I wanted to see him while all of him was still intact. I wanted to hold him. Instead of being with my fiancé, I was told I had to wait. I didn't see him until days later, when he was already embalmed and prepared for his funeral. It was beyond awful. There has been much speculation about Aaron's sexuality since his death. I can say this. Aaron was very much a man to me. I saw no indication that he was gay or homosexual. I wish I had known how he felt, just so we could have talked about it. I wouldn't have disowned him. I would have been supportive. I can't fault him if he was feeling that way. When you love someone so much, you just want to be there to support them. The fact that he felt he couldn't come out to me, or he couldn't tell me these things, hurts, because we had that bond. I've accepted that he may have been the way he was said to be, or that it may not be true. Regardless, I won't know. The alarming part is we'll never know exactly what was going through Aaron's mind during those final days, months, and years, and what impact CTE had. things I never picked up on, now I sit back and question. What was the real reason for this outburst, or that outburst, or him forgetting to do this, that, and 100 different things? It's hard to imagine how many people have CTE and their families have no idea. I haven't figured out how to tell my daughter about everything that happened. Aviel is healthy, and I'm breathing. She's very smart and asks a bunch of questions, especially about Daddy. When the time is right and she really wants to understand, I think she'll be all right. She's smart for her age, and that's important considering what she may face in the future. In his last note, written moments before he died, Aaron asked me to tell his story. I also know he had a similar conversation with Jose, because he felt he had a fighter in Jose, a big brother who would defend him to the end. Aaron and Jose grew extremely close during Aaron's final year on Earth. Jose never judged him. He was only there to help. That help extended to me and Aviel. Even after Aaron's passing, Jose is still here willing to keep fighting for Aaron and his legacy. The easiest thing for Jose to do is to take his incredible legal victory, which was achieved against all odds, and move on. But that is not Jose. I hope all those who listen to this audiobook see what we went through and understand the importance of having someone in your corner. While that was my role in Aaron's heart, Jose maintained that role in the courtroom. I also want to recognize that Jose was not alone. He put together the greatest legal team, which included Harvard professor Ronald Sullivan, Linda Kenny Bodden, George Leontire, and Michelle Medina. They became, and to this day remain, family, to not only Aaron, but to Aviel and myself. I'm glad Jose is telling Aaron's story. This is an insider's story written by the man who knew him best at a time of triumph and tragedy. I'm glad the truth will finally be told.
Chapter 1. The Beginning or the End. This was the part Aaron Hernandez hated most, having to say goodbye. The telephone calls with his high school sweetheart and devoted fiancée, Shayana, were never long enough. Their talks were his chance to escape the confines of prison and connect to a life outside the walls that kept closing in on him. "Babe, they're locking up now," Aaron said after a guard gave him that nod to end his call. Shayana Jenkins Hernandez also hated this part. Outwardly, she was free to live her life. But she was in bondage, too. The telephone calls to her fiancé were their only communication now, until she and her daughter, Aviel, could make their next visit. Each phone call had meaning, a couple sharing their day like any other couple would. "I love you," Shayana whispered. "I love you, too," Aaron said. "I'll call you tomorrow." Shayana would later speak of how their talk had been a good one. They dared to dream about a day when Aaron would be out of prison and free to be the father and husband he hoped he could be. He had been acquitted of double murder charges 5 days earlier, and now his previous conviction for the death of Odin Lloyd in 2013 would be appealed. Home to Aaron for now was Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in Lancaster, Massachusetts, located about an hour's drive west of Boston. The maximum security prison is where he was inmate W106228, serving, in what seems like a hopeless existence, life without parole. He would be there for 2 years. Handcuffed and dressed in the white and red wardrobe for prisoners, Aaron would be escorted back to his cell as he always was. Any guard, in a test of strength, would be no match for the younger, stronger, former Pro Bowl tight end. But as Aaron liked to say, those days are over. As they reached the second floor of the G2 housing unit, the guard yelled, "Open cell 57. Those heavy metal doors separate slowly, often squeaking like a pig in pain. This was the kind of night Aaron often told Shayana about. The nights when his trademark smile is gone and it's back to his reality. The loneliness, the solitude, and the bright light through the window. Aaron would often describe how he'd sit down on his bunk and rub his temples. His friends knew of his frequent migraines that began with a dull ache in his head. They had become more frequent of late. He would lie down and throw a t-shirt over his eyes to block the light shining through the small, barred window, about 18 inches wide and 3 feet long. "My head is going to explode," is how he once described it to Shayana. The migraines came with hot flashes. That's what he called them. He would then strip off his t-shirt and jailhouse pants until his 6'2" tattooed body was naked. He had mentioned doing this a lot in recent days, going from hot to cold, cold to hot. He would pace, holding his head. Aaron said it took 3 steps to pace from one end of the cell to the other. Back and forth he would pace, trying to concentrate on the steps to help keep his mind off his pain. He would think all kinds of things. If you knew Aaron, there was only one thing that brought him comfort in times like this. A picture of his 4-year-old daughter, Aviel. She always made him smile. She always made him feel better. Aviel, born on Aaron's birthdate of November 6th, looks just like Shayana. She has brown cocoa skin and gorgeous hazel eyes, just like her mother. To Aaron, his daughter and her mother are symbols of strength, beauty, love, and better times. "How is it possible to love someone so much?" Aaron would say. "Did I fuck it up?" Prison is scary quiet at night, except for the sounds of an occasional cough or a scream. No one really knows what Aaron was thinking on this night, or even if he was in his right mind. No one knows what kind of pain he felt. When did Aaron decide this would be his last night on Earth? Maybe the disease CTE knows. He was upbeat when he talked to me on the telephone earlier in the day. "I'm so happy," he said. "I can't remember the last time I was this happy." One moment he is lost in love and thankfulness, looking forward to a future as a free man again. Then the depression and the pain must have come back. Prison was his reality, the reality behind the smile. The past, the present, the pain, the paranoia had taken Aaron from the highest high to the lowest low, from playing in front of thousands of cheering fans to being alone in a prison cell. Aaron became religious in prison. He had learned from his college coach Urban Meyer that the Bible was the word of God, and those who believed would have everlasting life, an everlasting life free from judgment, free from pain, and free from depression. Aaron reached for the Bible on his final night. Perhaps he was searching for a promise. At some point, he turned to the New Testament, John 3:16. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Prison had been a constant battle. Fighting the justice system, fighting inmates, fighting officers, and fighting the depression caused by his choices. A drop of blood falls on the scripture, and John 3:16 would be scribbled in blood on Aaron's forehead. Somewhere during this time, Aaron must have decided that life was no longer worth living. Various correctional and law enforcement reports detail a timeline account of the final hours of Aaron Hernandez's life. He deserved a better ending than this. Here's what's believed to have happened. It's 3 a.m. on April 19th, 2017. Corrections Officer Gerard Brow is making his normal rounds at the G2 housing unit at Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center. He is working the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. As he slowly walks the unit's second floor, Brow looks into inmates' door windows to make sure they're where they're supposed to be. It's normally a boring routine. Brow reaches cell 57 and stops. There is a cloth or curtain of some sort blocking the window, preventing him from seeing into the cell. A lifelong Patriots fan, Brown knows it's a private cell for Aaron Hernandez, the former football star. Brown knocks on the door. There's no response. He knocks again with more force. Again, there is no response. Brown, bald and stocky, looks up to see part of what appears to be a curtain sticking through the top of the door. It's not uncommon for an inmate to do that. It's their way of having some fun with the guards. Brown reaches up, grabs the cloth, and slides it to the side, allowing him to look into the cell. His eyes grow wide with shock. Aaron Hernandez is naked, his tattoo-covered body dangling lifeless from a white bedsheet wrapped tightly around his neck. The bedsheet is attached to a bar in a back window, located a few feet higher than his 6'2", 240-pound frame. "Oh, shit. Oh, fuck," Brow says. With adrenaline flooding his body, Brow reaches for his radio and clicks it on. "Code 99. Repeat. Code 99. Inmate hanging, G2, cell 57," he yells. "Repeat. Code 99. It's Aaron." Regulations for officer safety prevent Brow from entering without a supervisor's approval. He begins to pace nervously as he waits for a response team to arrive. Seconds seem like minutes. Brow wonders whether he missed something during his rounds earlier that night. At this point, he realizes the screw-up. He did not make his rounds in the last hour, contrary to policy making it mandatory to check on inmates every hour. There will be hell to pay for this. At 3:05 a.m., corrections officers Sean Giles, Matthew Way, and Nicholas Lawton arrive and give the okay to enter the cell. Brow hurriedly unlocks the door and tries to push it open. There's resistance. It barely budges. "Help me," Brow says. "It won't open." It takes the strength of three grown men, Giles, Way, and Brow, to push the door open. Once inside, they see that it had been blocked by various paper materials, including a piece of cardboard from the back of a notepad. They also quickly notice that the floor of the small cell is covered with a soapy substance, perhaps shampoo. It's hard to keep their balance. The corrections officer's instincts are to save Aaron's life. Brow rushes to grab Aaron's nude body by the legs, while Giles follows regulations by handcuffing the inmate's wrists. It seems like a useless exercise, but it follows regulations. Giles then helps Brow lift Aaron's lifeless body upward to relieve the pressure from around his neck. Officer Way, who is built like a power lifter, grabs a pair of shears brought into the cell and tries to cut through the bed sheet wrapped around Aaron's neck. The sheet is tighter than wet rope. Officers and medical personnel throughout the prison have been alerted. The whole prison is abuzz. Soon the cell has more people than it can hold. Sergeant David Lambert is next to arrive and begins assisting Brow and Giles to hold up Aaron in case there is some chance for a miracle. All are struggling with maintaining their leverage on the slippery floor. Way, meanwhile, is still having trouble cutting through the fabric. The shears are dull and the bedsheet is wound with knots meticulously tied in different locations. "It's just not cutting," Way says in frustration. Corrections officers Tyler Courtney and Edmund Pavia, along with a medical team consisting of nurses Kelly Ryder and Colleen Narvaez, arrive at the cell. As Way struggles to cut through the sheet, Courtney stands on the bed and helps lift Aaron's cold body by pushing under his arm, creating more slack in the bedsheet. It takes nearly 2 minutes of frantic cutting before the dull shears finally slice through the bedsheet. It seems like it took forever. Once the material is cut, Aaron is lowered to the floor and Courtney loosens and then removes the noose from around his neck. Is he still alive? Is he breathing? Ryder checks for a pulse. There is none. Aaron isn't breathing. Brow, Giles, and Lawton immediately begin CPR. There is still no response. Ryder looks closer at Aaron's body and sees he has defecated on himself. His body is cyanotic. He is cold to the touch, and his ears and lips are blue. All signs of death. As CPR continues, Ryder radios for a life support ambulance that will bring advanced life-saving equipment and an experienced paramedic. 10 minutes after Aaron is first discovered, a stretcher arrives at his cell. Other inmates are straining through their small door windows to see what's going on. Aaron's body is placed on a stretcher, his hands still in restraints, and carried by corrections officers to a downstairs holding room where he is placed on a gurney, where Courtney continues CPR at a rate of 100 compressions per minute. At 3:25 a.m., the ambulance arrives. Paramedics take over medical care and hook Aaron to a heart monitor. They also stick an intravenous line into his leg. Everyone is moving quickly. Time is of the essence. No one is ready to give up. As Aaron is being placed in the ambulance, the gurney somehow gets stuck halfway in. This can't be happening. Courtney continues CPR while an EMT officer struggles to unhinge the gurney. "Push," he tells his team. After a hard shove, the gurney slides into the ambulance. The door closes. Aaron is leaving prison, but not the way he imagined. He is transported to UMass Memorial Health Alliance Hospital in nearby Leominster, Massachusetts, where he is placed in emergency room 1. Hospital personnel greet the ambulance and resume life-saving measures. Among those working on Aaron is Dr. Evan Swayze, an emergency medicine doctor with 17 years of experience. He knows it is hopeless. Aaron's body, still in restraints, has shown no sign of life since it was discovered an hour earlier. Swayze takes a step back and pronounces time of death at 4:07 a.m. Aaron Hernandez, the former high school standout, college All-American, and NFL football star, was pronounced dead while naked and in restraints. He was 27 years old. Chapter 2.
Fuck yeah.
The letter arrived on May 15th, 2016. Jose, I have heard a lot about you from Christina, and I'm very intrigued. I am not sure where to start, but I really just want to touch base with you on everything on my end, where I'm at in my thoughts going forward. I also want to know about your mindset on appeals and your experience with them. I have heard that your resume is very impressive, the reason I'm reaching out to you. Hopefully, this may lead to something positive in my future. As you most likely know, I am currently serving a life sentence for a crime I didn't do. Yes, all convicts say they're innocent, or most, but there are actually many that truly are, as I'm sure you know, being in this profession dealing with this corrupt system. My trial was definitely not a fair trial. I was convicted before I went to trial. It was all over the media, evidence allowed in court, as well as evidence not admissible. That's only the beginning of it, but all in all, there's so much to talk of if we go forward in the future. It all depends on if you're interested, if could truly help, and where your head is at with this. I'm just trying to fight for my life and not do life for something I didn't do. My COD, one of them just beat his case and was only convicted of accessory after the fact, sentenced to a 4.5 to 7 year bid. The other hasn't went to trial yet. I truly believe there's a ton of things to attack in this trial, or at least I hope, but time will tell. I have two lawyers currently working on my appeal, court appointed. I'm not sure your views on everything, but going forward, if you could truly help, we will figure a way to make it happen in this battle marathon to get my freedom back. I am going to trial soon for another murder trial, which I should win, but who knows with this system. I just hope I receive a fair trial. There is a lot going on, and I just wanted to touch base with you, hoping something positive can come from it. So, if you have a second, I would truly appreciate you getting back to me and letting me know your mindset on whatever comes to mind. I hope you're interested, for I feel that something can be done to take steps closer to my freedom. I am going to let you go. I hope to hear from you soon. I hope all your loved ones are doing well as yourself. I will be in touch. Sent with respect, Aaron Hernandez, W106228, P.O. Box 8000, Shirley, Massachusetts, 01464. I'd known of Aaron Hernandez long before that letter arrived. I went to Florida State University, FSU, in the early 1990s and was a big college football fan. I have to admit that when I first saw Aaron playing tight end for the University of Florida, the main in-state rival school of FSU, I didn't like him. After seeing him destroy my Seminoles on the football field, I was sure I hated him. Still, I followed him when he got drafted by the Patriots in 2010 and as he emerged as a young star in the NFL. He reached the Super Bowl in 2011, and I remembered he had signed a $40 million contract. I admired him for being one of the few Hispanic players in the NFL to make it. I immediately took notice when he was named as the number one suspect in the murder of Odin Lloyd, who had been dating Shayana's sister. I thought there was a good chance I might be on the short list of lawyers he was considering hiring for his case. We shared a Puerto Rican heritage and had ties to the state of Florida. I even asked around to see if anyone had heard my name being mentioned. I got mixed feedback. A reporter called me and told me he had heard I was being mentioned by sources close to Aaron, but that turned out not to be true. I didn't get the call. When elite athletes get themselves in trouble, they go to their agents and managers. You look at guys like Aaron and Mike Tyson, the former heavyweight champion convicted of rape. They follow their handler's advice, and their handlers base their judgments on their relationships, not necessarily who is the best person for the job. So Aaron ended up with a lead attorney in his first case named Michael K. Fee, who worked for a large national firm. Those lawyers do not try murder cases. Usually their cases are white-collar crimes, if they do any criminal work at all. Trust me when I tell you there is a huge difference between the worlds of murder and white-collar crime cases. I would be surprised if he had ever represented a defendant in a murder case. The truth is, I don't know. Aaron had millions of dollars and could have put up a defense that most accused citizens could only dream of, but that was the case. His dream team failed him. He was convicted for murdering Lloyd and sentenced to life without parole. At this point, I was reluctant to defend him on charges of killing two men during a shooting at a downtown traffic light in Boston in July 2012. It's difficult to defend someone in a murder case, and even more difficult when they've already been convicted of murder and have a reputation as a thug, gangbanger, and reckless athlete who had blown a prosperous career in the NFL. I also questioned whether he had the financial resources to build a proper defense. Hiring a defense team and investigators takes money. Aaron had signed a $40 million contract extension with the New England Patriots in August of 2012, with part of the $12.5 million signing bonus deferred. When he was arrested in June 2013, the Patriots released him from the team and refused to pay the remaining $3.2 million of his signing bonus. I figured I would at least meet Aaron and hear what he had to say. A week after he contacted me, I met him for the first time in the visiting room at Sousa Baranowski. I asked my good friend and colleague Ronald S. Sullivan Jr. to come with me. Sully, as we call him, is a Harvard law professor, and I figured if I ended up taking the case, it would be good to have someone I trusted nearby to help out. The first thing I noticed was that Aaron was bigger than I expected. He was listed at 6'2", but believe me, Aaron was much bigger. He looked more like 6'4", 250 pounds. I had represented football players before, and Aaron looked the part and then some. Although he was heavily tattooed and in prison, his smile and handshake were warm and friendly. We met in a part of the prison that looked like a large cafeteria, but wasn't. It was where inmates had their contact visits with their families. As lawyers, we were allowed to go into a private room and speak to Aaron with plenty of privacy while a guard stood outside the door. Aaron was gracious and complimentary when we met. He extended his hand and we gave each other a firm handshake. "Man, I have heard so much about you," he said. "Thank you so much for coming to see me. I really appreciate it." We sat down and began by discussing the appeal of his conviction in the Odin Lloyd case. He was very concerned with the fact that he felt he did not get a fair trial. He explained how before he set foot in a real courtroom, the court of public opinion had already convicted him. "Welcome to my world," I chimed in. "Absolutely every person accused in a high-profile case feels convicted before the trial begins. Our laws do not protect the constitutional presumption of innocence the way they protect the constitutionally based freedom of the press. Unless the defense lawyer knows exactly how to address this in each and every phase of the trial, they will likely lose. Unfortunately, 99% of the lawyers out there have never handled a national high-profile case before, or do not invest the time in the minute details required to truly combat media-induced bias in the courtroom." As I was explaining this to Aaron, I could see he was following every word and asking serious, insightful questions. Like, "So you take the approach of attempting to insert reasonable doubt not only during jury selection, but in all phases of the trial, including but not limited to cross-examination?" This is no stupid jock, I thought to myself. Our conversation shifted to the Boston double murder trial he was set to start in a couple of months. His initial thoughts were to hire me for the appeal and continue working with his current lawyers on the trial in Boston. He liked his current lawyers. He thought they were capable and had genuine feelings of affection for them. "I think if you like your lawyers, you should stay with them, and let's talk again after your double murder trial, because if you lose that one, the Odin Lloyd appeal is almost meaningless." He quickly followed the logic and asked, "How would you feel about representing me in the Boston case?" "Well, let's talk about it. Tell me what happened," I said. "I didn't do it," Aaron told me, his eyes piercing. "Okay," I said. "Tell me what you know." "It was my boy Sherrod. He had some beef with those dudes. I still don't know why he did that shit, but my dumbass just kept hanging around him like an idiot. It was almost as if we had one of those toxic relationships where you really care about someone, but you just know they are no good for you. Do you know what I mean?" He said this in a way that expressed real affection for this Sherrod guy. Not in a homosexual way, but like a brother. I asked him, "But Aaron, you had so much. Why would you risk it all for someone like that?" He dipped his head, stared down at his hands on the table, and said, "I know. I can't explain it. Sometimes I have extreme difficulty with impulse control. It's like I can't control it, and I constantly go back and question why the fuck do I hang out with these people? And why don't I just say no?" He literally used the words, "extreme difficulty with impulse control." Then he continued, "Jose, believe me, I am innocent. I have never killed anyone. Anyone, period. he said emphatically. I just do some really stupid shit, and I can never understand why. We then discussed the Boston case at length. Sherrod, whose real name was Alexander Bradley, had testified before a grand jury, and Aaron had received a copy of the transcript from his lawyers. Aaron had it committed to memory and could almost recite Bradley's testimony verbatim. But as we talked more, I noticed Aaron sometimes had an amazing memory and sometimes a horrible one. He couldn't even give me the name of some of his lawyers, or of people who handled his money. It was odd. One minute I felt I was talking to an incredibly intelligent and sophisticated man. Another minute, I felt like I was speaking to a child. Aaron seemed more frustrated by the lapses than I was. I could see he really disliked that part of himself. One thing I noticed right away and throughout the entire time I knew him was his heart. It was genuine. He wasn't a fake. He owned his flaws and never made excuses for them. He also had a sense of humor, which I could tell was going to make this case interesting, to say the least. There was an immediate bond. We were both of Puerto Rican descent, and we had some similarities in our personalities. He always understood what I meant and how I meant it. Most lawyers like to speak in legalese and always keep a certain distance from their clients. It's like they feel that some of their dirt or criminality is going to rub off on them. I am not that way. I like to understand my clients. I try to speak to them on a level that's real. I believe if you truly understand the person you're representing, you can convey that to a jury, and in many cases, the jury can see them through you as you fight for their cause. People always ask me, "What's your secret to winning cases?" I don't know. I wish I could bottle it up and sell it. But I know this much. Understanding your client and remembering that you are not only fighting for them, but also for the family who wants them back home, is key to showing the jury a level of sincerity that wins trials. Many lawyers simply do not understand or want to understand their clients and are just doing their job. I wanted Aaron to immediately understand what I was trying to do. So I looked him in the eye and told him, "I'm Jose. Nice to meet you. I'm your new best friend, your priest, your father, your brother, everything. People have to see you through me. When I try your case, I want people to look at me and believe as I'm defending you that I'm you, or at least that we're relatable." That was the beginning of my relationship with an Aaron Hernandez that probably no one else really knew. An Aaron Hernandez who died way too young for reasons no one understands. We met for more than 8 hours that day. I looked at the case from his perspective as we talked and saw the state's case had more holes in it than Swiss cheese. But it was being held together by Aaron's bad boy gangster image. Usually when the media hype is keeping a case together and not the evidence, my eyes light up and I can feel the hair on the back of my neck stand up, because I can see something is just not right. At the end of our meeting that day, I said to him, "Aaron, get ready, because we are about to start some shit up." I could see Aaron's mood light up like a rising phoenix as he slapped my extended hand and with a smile said, "Fuck yeah." Chapter 3, Blood in Boston. Aquilino Friere was catching up on some much-needed rest and never heard his cell phone ring when his friends Gerson Lopez and Rashidas Gomez Sanchez called from Providence. It was Sunday morning, July 15th, 2012. After getting no answer, Lopez, 24, and Sanchez, 30, decided to take Lopez's car and make the hour's drive to Friere's home and ring his doorbell. That's when Friere woke up. "Yo, wake up," his friends shouted as he opened the door. Friere, 26, had arrived from Cape Verde, a small island off the coast of West Africa, 4 years earlier, and had since lived in the Dorchester section of Boston, where there is a large concentration of African Americans and foreign-born immigrants from the Caribbean, West Africa, and Asia. Friere, known as Del Mar to those close to him, invited his friends in. He wasn't at all surprised they were there. This was a weekend ritual of sorts. Going out and having a good time was all part of the American dream. It was time to decide on their plans for the day and into the evening. "My baby mama is having a cookout at her house," Friere said. "It's my baby mama's brother's birthday. Do you want to go?" All agreed it would be a good way to start the day. Some food, a few drinks, and whatever else might happen was intriguing enough to go to the nearby cookout before getting on with the rest of the day's activities. Friere took a shower while Lopez and Sanchez waited. Within an hour, they were at the cookout on Elm Street. Another friend, Zafiro Furtado, was already there. Furtado, 28, lived across the street from Delmar's baby mama's house and was a frequent visitor to the home, where there were often parties, whether planned or impromptu. Furtado had tight, light brown skin and a slim body conditioned from playing countless hours of soccer. He had been a tour guide in Cape Verde and had gone to school through the 11th grade. He arrived in America in December of 2011 to visit his mother and sister who lived in Dorchester and planned to return to Cape Verde in August. To make money while in Boston, he worked with his cousin cleaning business offices and schools overnight, usually working from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. As the four friends began to settle in at the cookout, Freire's cell phone rang again. It was Daniel de Abreu calling.
"Where are you guys at?" Abreu said.
"I'm about to get off work. What we doing tonight?"
Abreu, 29, was one of 12 children that included 9 sisters. He was also from Cape Verde and had spent nearly 3 years in the Cape Verde military after high school. After leaving the military, he served as an officer for the Cape Verde National Police for 5 years before coming to the United States in August of 2008. Like many immigrants, he came to the States to visit family members in Boston. He too worked in the cleaning business in the overnight shift. Sundays were his days to relax and have some fun. Freire told Abreu about the cookout and to meet the group there. Abreu said he would ask his sister Neusa if he could borrow her BMW, and later called her to make arrangements to meet her when she got home from work. They met at their mother's house, where Abreu took the car keys. It was about 7:30 in the evening.
"I'm just going to go out and have some fun," he told his sister. "I'll see you in the morning."
"Make sure you bring it back in the morning," his sister told him.
"I've never let you down," Abreu said.
When Abreu arrived at the party, he pulled his sister's silver four-door 2003 BMW 325 XI into Furtado's driveway. The group of five mingled at the cookout for a couple of hours, but as night closed, they decided to plot their next move. Someone suggested going to a liquor store and getting something to drink before heading to a nightclub. They had already had Coronas at the cookout, but Freire wanted something that would give him a stronger buzz. The young men said their goodbyes to the backyard party, then stopped by a liquor store on Dudley Street to buy a bottle of vodka and some cranberry juice. Drinks in a club could be expensive. It was better to consume as much as possible before arriving. The men piled into the silver BMW and headed back to Delmar's house to change into their nightclub clothes. They decided to go to Cure Lounge in Boston's theater district. The group went out at least every other Sunday night to a party or nightclub where they would have a few drinks, dance, and try to talk with girls despite their thick Cape Verdean accents. Cure was a popular spot on Sundays because Latin and hip-hop were the primary music played on those nights. Furtado initially didn't want to go back out. He didn't want to drink and feel sluggish the next day. "I have to play soccer tomorrow," he said as the others changed. "You guys go." After being promised the group would not stay out long, Furtado eventually agreed to join them. All were in good spirits as they headed to downtown Boston, excited about the evening ahead. It was 11 o'clock. Abreu was the only one who had been to Cure Lounge, a trendy spot where locals mingled with celebrities. After parking the car in the garage at Tufts Medical Center, a covered garage that also serviced the public, the five friends walked up Tremont Street to the club entrance. Sunday was industry night, designed to attract people who worked in the club industry. Most were off on Sundays, and it offered an attraction for what otherwise would be a slow night. All five worked their way through the velvet ropes, waiting to enter the club. It was like waiting for a ride at Disney World. As they waited, two extremely tall and muscular men began to cross Tremont Street, right near the club line. One would later be revealed to have been Alexander Bradley, the other NFL football star Aaron Hernandez. As Bradley and Hernandez walked past the line, Abreu immediately turned to his left and as a result avoided any eye contact with the two men. Bradley and Hernandez, meanwhile, lingered on the corner of Stewart and Tremont while finishing a bottle of water, waiting for the line to clear. Bradley then gestured toward the line in the direction of Abreu and said something unintelligible. Both men decided to head toward the Cure waiting line. The football star started shaking hands with all the club security employees as he walked down the line, greeting them as if they were old friends from the neighborhood. Freire, Abreu, Furtado, Sanchez, and Lopez each paid the $25 cover charge, a price they thought well worth the evening's entertainment. As they were paying the cover charge, Jeffrey London, the club's VIP promoter,
greeted Hernandez and immediately ushered him into the nightclub, bypassing the cashier, and as fate would have it, directly behind the five Cape Verdean men. To anyone who might be paying attention, including bouncer Jamie Furtado, all seven men looked like they were entering the club together. It stood out on what would be a slow night. While he is not a football fan, Furtado notices Aaron Hernandez's size and watches him closely as Hernandez says a couple of words to someone in the group of seven, then casually walks to the main bar and orders a drink. Abreu pays for the first round of drinks for his group, five Coronas. Once the beer is gone, Friere sips on a shot of Hennessy as he watches the crowd, and then gets Saphiro Furtado to buy him another shot once the first was finished. Abreu then spots an attractive blonde girl by the name of Paige Aiello and decides to strike up a conversation. His friends watch him as he tries to be pleasant and make small talk. Eventually, he is persuasive enough for Aiello to agree to dance with him for a bit. Aiello, a frequent clubgoer, would later testify that she had seen Aaron Hernandez at Cure many times before, but did not see him on that evening. Sanchez's luck isn't as good. He tries to talk to a tall, white-skinned woman who wants no part of his attention. When Sanchez persists, she finds a bouncer and tells him Sanchez is bothering her. The bouncer gives Sanchez a mild warning and tells him to leave the girl alone. Sanchez backs off and spends the rest of the evening with his group.
"She's a racist," he mumbles under his breath.
When last call is announced just before the 2 a.m. closing, the five friends head for the exit happy with their evening. They had danced with a few girls, enjoyed their drinks, and people watched. They had no confrontations, no fights, nothing out of the ordinary. A normal night, Friere would call it. No problems. Once in the night air, they linger for about 30 minutes for what is called the let-out. Since all clubs close at the same time, there is no shortage of intoxicated people on the sidewalks looking for one last encounter to see who might get lucky. Abreu is trying the hardest. He begins to kiss and hug Aiello, who seems willing at times and other moments not so much. As the streets die down, Friere, Abreu, and Furtado slowly make their way up the stairs to get the BMW parked in the garage, while Lopez and Sanchez wait to be picked up on the sidewalk. Lopez and Sanchez begin laughing at two gay men kissing as the couple walks by. It isn't long before the silver BMW stops abruptly in front of them. A smiling Abreu is in the driver's seat, still thinking about the beautiful woman he talked to. Furtado is in the front passenger seat. Friere winds up in the middle as Sanchez, on the passenger side, and Lopez, behind the driver, join him in the back seat. It's 2:20 a.m. Hungry after their night of drinking, they decide to go to Boston's Chinatown. Abreu turns on the car's air conditioner, rolls up the windows, and steps on the accelerator. The silver BMW begins heading south on Tremont Street, which turns into Chalmette Avenue, just up the road on the other side of Oak Street. As the car crosses the overpass that covers the always busy Massachusetts Turnpike, the BMW reaches the intersection of Chalmette Avenue and Herald Street. The traffic light turns from yellow to red. Abreu presses the brakes and flicks on his turn signal to make a left turn from the left lane. The five immigrants are conversing about the night as they listen to a CD Sanchez, an amateur rapper, produced. He plans to make it big one day. One block behind them, Donald Gobin, 49, and Brian Kwan, 48, are heading home after working security at the Underbar, a nightclub close to Cure. Gobin notices how quiet things are as the co-workers walk up the left-hand side of Tremont Street and work their way toward a silver Saturn parked near Oak Street. Once they reach the car, Gobin opens the door and slips into the driver's seat. He turns on the ignition and drives the car forward before stopping at a red light on Marginal Road. As the security guards are stopped at the light, an SUV pulls up about an arm's length next to them. Kwan, sitting in the passenger seat, looks to his right and sees a dark-skinned male driving the SUV and feels him staring at him. Gobin questions himself as to why the SUV is so close and follows his instinctive habit. He inches his SUV forward just a bit, breaking direct line of sight with the opposite car. It's a tactic he often employs late at night, just to be safe and avoid any kind of potential road rage with drunken drivers. As Kwan turns back toward Gobin, the driver of the SUV next to them suddenly guns it and runs the red light. Gobin, who has a thing about recognizing state license plates, notes that the SUV's tags are from Rhode Island, where both he and Kwan are from. "Where's this loser going in such a hurry?" Gobin says with a laugh. The SUV speeds over the overpass to the next traffic light, and quickly pulls up in the right lane next to the BMW waiting at Harold Street. Freire and his four passengers think nothing of it until someone in the SUV yells, "What's up now, niggas?" Then at least five shots ring out in rapid succession. Pow, 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 pow. Bullet after bullet after bullet. A seemingly endless stream of deadly destruction blends with the sound of cars racing along the Mass Pike under the overpass. The shots finally end, and the SUV speeds away with wheels squealing. Still waiting for the light at Marginal Road, Quan turns to Gopin. His face expresses disbelief. "I think that was gunshots." Gopin is unsure. "Where?" he asks. Quan points toward the traffic light ahead of them. A car is stopped in the left lane. The light at Marginal Road turns green, and Gopin slowly presses the accelerator of his Saturn, unsure whether he should rush to the scene of gunshots. As they drive closer, they see the silver BMW surrounded by shattered glass. "I think that car got shot up," Gopin says. "What makes you think so?" Quan asks. "See the glass on the road?" Gopin says. Quan replies, "Oh yeah, that's true." As Gopin and Quan roll closer to the BMW, suddenly the back doors swing open on both sides. Gopin stops his vehicle. Lopez rolls out of the left side of the BMW. He stands and checks the white t-shirt he is wearing, looking for wounds. He then checks his dark-colored pants. He sees no injuries. Sanchez pops out from the right side of the car. He looks at his maroon shirt. There's blood, but his legs are fine. He can run. Gopin slowly steps on the gas and inches his Saturn alongside the BMW. He and Quan look into the front seat of the bullet-riddled car. Two men sit motionless in the front seats. Quan thinks whoever is in the passenger seat is dead. His face is covered in blood. The driver, Abreu, is gasping desperately for his last breaths. His eyes are open. They show fear and desperation. Blood is pouring out from a hole in his chest. It's a gruesome scene. Gopin and Quan have trouble comprehending what has happened. They roll past the BMW and pull over to the curb, unsure what to do next. A terrified Freire is on the floor of the back seat with his arms covering his head. Slowly, he looks out to see if the carnage has ended. He checks himself and sees his shirt is covered in blood. He has been grazed by bullets in the right and left forearms. Freire looks next to him. Sanchez and Lopez have exited the car. His friends in the front seat, Abreu and Furtado, are motionless. Furtado's face is a ball of red. There is a hole above his right eye. Scared and in a state of shock, Sanchez's first instinct is to run. He is afraid the shooter will return. He starts walking away from the car, leaving his friends behind. He spends the next 2 hours walking around downtown Boston, his shirt soaked in so much blood that passing taxicabs refuse to pick him up and take him to Brockton. He will not get home for several hours. A panic-stricken Lopez deserts the scene as well, leaving Freire, the only coherent victim left, to find help on his own. A day that began with a friendly cookout has turned into a tragedy. This was not the American dream the five immigrants from Cape Verde envisioned. Freire climbs out of the back seat and begins frantically waving his arms. He sees a car ahead and starts walking toward it. It's Gopin's Saturn. "Help us! Help us!" Freire pleads as he approaches the car. As a bloody Freire gets closer, Quan fears he might have a weapon and tells Gopin, "Go around the corner." Gopin drives just far enough from the commotion to feel safe and calls 911. He's connected to the Massachusetts State Police and quickly transferred to the Boston Police Department dispatcher. Gopin reports the shooting and the possibility of at least one death. He gives the location and is told police are on their way. Gopin hangs up and looks at Quan. They discuss going back to the scene, then decide a killer is still on the loose and perhaps they would be safer at home. They head toward Highway 93 and drive back to Rhode Island. At 2:34 a.m. on July 16, 2012, Boston police officer Luciano Cirino is flagged down by a frantic taxicab driver, alerting him that shots have been fired on Chaumont Avenue. Cirino, a member of the Boston police force since 2006, immediately notifies dispatch and speeds to the scene. Once he arrives, Cirino sees the bullet-riddled BMW stationary in the street with the two rear doors open and glass on the road. Freire is on a nearby sidewalk screaming frantically for help. "These are my best friends. Help me, please." Serino then sees two black males in the driver and front passenger seats of a BMW. They're not moving. The officer calls in his location and requests additional units as well as emergency medical services, EMS. Officer Thomas O'Donnell of the Boston Police Department arrives and sees a street sweeper slowly pass through the crime scene and thinks, how is that happening? Within minutes, EMS arrives on the scene and pronounces Abreu and Furtado dead from their wounds. Boston EMS paramedic David Chaffee makes a decision to cover the victims with sheets to preserve dignity. An autopsy conducted on July 17, 2012, would later show Abreu died from a gunshot wound to the right side of his chest. He also had a bullet wound under his right arm. Furtado had gunshot wounds just above his right eye, which lodged in his head. He also had another wound to the right side of his head and his right shoulder. Friere had a gunshot wound to his right forearm and a graze wound to his left forearm. 2 days after the shooting, he could not offer police a description of who pulled the trigger. Within minutes, the scene is crawling with police, and crime scene tape is in place blocking access to both sides of Chaumont Avenue. A law enforcement official would leak to the media that the victims were from a Cape Verdean gang based in Dorchester. The official requested anonymity because he was not authorized to speak about the case. It was Boston's 25th and 26th homicides that year. Exactly 1 month later, Aaron Hernandez signed a $40 million contract extension with the New England Patriots. He would later tell reporters, "Now that it happened, it's definitely a blessing. I'm excited to go on with my life." Chapter 4, Magical Monday and the Luck of the Irish. Aaron Hernandez didn't become a suspect until nearly a year after the killings of Daniel de Abreu and Zafiro Furtado. Up to then, the case had gone stale and was largely forgotten after Boston homicide detectives failed to come up with a credible suspect. Two black immigrants shot dead in their car on Boston's South End wasn't exactly big news in New England, where anything about the Red Sox, Celtics, and Patriots dominated the daily headlines. Boston was also still recovering physically and emotionally from the April 15, 2013 bombing at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. The act of terrorism had killed three people and injured hundreds of others. But the cold case heated up on Wednesday, June 19, 2013. Mark Sullivan, a very unusually tanned, Irish 40-something-year-old sergeant detective with the Boston Police Homicide Unit, was watching the news and saw that Aaron was a suspect in the death of Odin Lloyd, who was dating Shayana's sister Shania, a resident of Dorchester. Detective Sullivan's interest was piqued because he remembered the video footage he had seen of Hernandez entering Cure Lounge at the same time as the Cape Verdeans on the night of the Boston shootings on July 16, 2012. Sullivan, a 20-year veteran of the Boston Police Department, was still the squad supervisor investigating the case and hadn't forgotten the details. When he got to work, the first thing he did was to hold a meeting with his entire squad and inform them that they were going to begin tracing the whereabouts of Aaron Hernandez on that night. And just like that, Aaron Hernandez became the lead suspect in the deaths of Daniel de Abreu and Zafiro Furtado. This was an unusual way to start an investigation, to say the least. Police don't usually decide on a probable suspect and start looking for a way to connect him to a crime. They usually follow the evidence and see who it leads them to, not the other way around. What was truly stunning was just how quickly their case developed and how lucky they would get. Sullivan ordered a detailed analysis of video footage taken in and around Cure Lounge on the morning of July 16, 2012, with the primary focus on tracking Hernandez's movements that night. Detective Joshua Cummings was assigned the task and observed video surveillance footage showing Hernandez pulling into the Tufts parking garage at about 12:04 a.m., driving a silver 2006 Toyota 4Runner with Rhode Island license plate 635035. Hernandez is seen wearing a gray baseball hat with a red or orange brim and a gray t-shirt with a red, green, and white design on the front. He is with a then-unknown dark-skinned Hispanic male or light-skinned black male, later identified as Alexander Bradley. The two men are seen entering the club immediately after the five men from Cape Verde: Furtado, Abreu, Sanchez, Friere, and Lopez. Hernandez and Bradley go downstairs into Cure, where there are no operable cameras. They appear again and exit about 9 minutes later, after Hernandez consumes two drinks and takes a photo with a fan. After hanging around outside for several minutes and crossing the street at 1:10 a.m., Hernandez is seen leaving the garage approximately 1 hour before the shootings, driving the silver 4Runner with Bradley in the front passenger seat. Detective Cummings then looked at other street cameras and saw an SUV similar in color and shape appear to be looping the block on Tremont Street and Stewart Street in the area of Cure. About an hour later, at 2:10 a.m., the Cape Verdean group is seen leaving Cure Lounge. As Lopez and Sanchez wait on the sidewalk while Abreu